All right. So thank you so much. It is always great to be back here at Waterloo and at PI. So I'm going to talk about some brand new stuff in this talk. Stuff that's so fresh. It's not even on the archive yet. Thought that that would be more fun than talking about older stuff. But when I did a Google image search for a quantum computer, you know, this is one of the first things that came up. When I Googled for a black hole, this came up. So that's, I guess that's what they look like. I don't know. So my starting point for this talk is, I'm interested in connections between computer science and physics, and the reason I love coming to Waterloo is, you know, this is like the, you know, the like the one town in the world where, you know, they won't necessarily institutionalize you. You know, if you think that there's a deep connection between these things, or rather, maybe they will institutionalize you, but the institution will be this one, or it'll be IQC, which are fairly nice ones. And I'm interested in this bridge, you know, for sort of a selfish reason, which is that, you know, I would like to understand nature. I'd like to understand the laws of physics, but the only way that I'm ever going to do so is if, you know, I can phrase things in terms of information and computation, and so I need this bridge for my own benefit, and you know, hopefully it would, you know, be to others' benefit also. But the question is, you know, I mean, people have, you know, Wheeler, like Feynman, you know, have talked for decades about, you know, connections between information and physics. But you know, what's the actual sort of technical content that will sort of allow us to, you know, sort of pass ideas from one to the other? And more than 20 years, you know, we've had, you know, one sort of extremely striking connection between these fields, which is quantum computing. And so I'd say that for a large part of my career, sort of, you know, everything that sort of I, you know, tried to do about physics was sort of modulated through this connection to quantum computing. So, you know, it's sort of like the renormalization group, right? Where like everything about the physics at the, you know, at the super small scales is just, you know, modulated through these, you know, these few constants that we're able to measure, you know, at our scales, right? Everything I was able to measure about physics, you know, pass through, you know, knowing about qubits and you know, what's a qubit, what's a quantum circuit, what is quantum polynomial time, and you know, and that can actually get you fairly far, right? There's a lot of, you know, of physical insight that you can express just in terms of the quantum model of computation, in terms of quantum algorithms and things like that. Okay, but I guess, you know, for the last 7 or 8 years or so, you know, I've been trying to sort of go a little further than that, or, you know, maybe like this bridge is just too overloaded with traffic, and we need to build some more bridges between computer science and physics. So yesterday I talked at IQC about boson sampling, which is a way to sort of connect the physics of bosons, you know, like photons, for example, to computational complexity. Okay, and it's all based on this sort of very, very remarkable fact that the amplitudes for bosons are given by the permanence of matrices, and the amplitudes for identical fermions to, you know, transition from some input to some output state are given by the determinants of matrices. Okay, and the permanent and determinant are these extremely basic functions in theoretical computer science for reasons having nothing to do with physics. And you know, and so what my student Alex Arkhipov and I and others have done over the, you know, last, 5 or 6 years or so, is to try to milk that connection for all it's worth, basically, and use the fact that the permanent is a famous hard function in computer science to get formulate arguments about the hardness of simulating systems of bosons on a conventional computer. Okay, by contrast, systems of identical non-interacting fermions are much easier to simulate because for fermions you only have determinants, and determinants are much easier to calculate. Okay, so this was sort of an amazing connection between computational complexity and physics, which is not sort of easily statable in terms of qubits. It sort of goes beyond that, and you have to know something about at least that our world is made of bosons and fermions. And I sort of take things slowly. Maybe this is the physics of 1925 or so, and that's the physics of 1928. Just within the last 3 years, there was a really remarkable connection that was made by a whole community of people, one that I wasn't expecting, sort of. But it's basically in understanding the black hole information problem and ADS-CFT and the issues having to do with firewalls. It was realized that a lot of the main issues really are issues of quantum information. They're about quantum circuits, about entanglement, and some of them are even about quantum computational complexity. Okay, so I sort of had no choice but to, get a little involved with this, and I'll try to tell you, my understanding of it. Of course, my background is in computer science and math. I'm not a physicist, but I have spent many years, hanging around with them and sort of being a complexity consultant for physicists. So, I at least know, I can tell you sort of what I've done for physicists on consulting assignments. And, and I can try to, answer questions about the physics itself, but, but no guarantees. Okay. So, and I think that there are a lot more connections to be made between, theoretical computer science and the actual content of modern physics, and I'll mention some of them toward the end of this talk. Okay. So, it may seem bizarre that, that these two worlds of black holes and, these are complexity classes, which this picture probably looks cooler to most people than this one, but I like this one also. So it might seem surprising that there would be a connection. So let me try to explain to you. This is already outdated. Last year should be 2 years ago. Let me try to explain to you one of the connections, and this was one that was made by Daniel Harlow and Patrick Hayden, which I found quite striking. But first I'll have to sort of review 40 years of black hole history in one slide. Okay, so this story sort of starts with the famous discovery of Bekenstein and Hawking in the 1970s that black holes actually have a non-zero temperature. They radiate. If you give them enough time, like 10 to the 70th years or so for an astrophysical black hole, they will radiate away. Okay, but there was a problem, which is that the same calculation that you can do in quantum field theory and curved spacetime that tells you that this radiation is coming out also tells you that this radiation should be thermal. Okay, it should be just completely uncorrelated with whatever information fell in to create the black hole. Okay, and this is a problem if you would like to sort of believe in the supremacy of quantum mechanics, right? Just say that quantum mechanics applies to every physical system, and from far enough away, if I don't go near a black hole, but if I just drop some qubits into it and then wait for Hawking radiation to come out, then I should be able to treat that as just another example of a unitary scattering process, right? It should just be some unitary transformation, you know, which, you know, in principle, I you know, if not in practice, I could invert, you know, in order to recover the original states that had fallen in. Okay, you know, I say, you know, in practice, this would be much, much harder than, let's say, you know, unscrambling an egg or, you know, recovering a burned book from the smoke and ash or whatever. But, you know, just as we believe that the, you know, the information in the book, you know, is still there in the smoke and ash, you know, if you want to believe in quantum mechanics or even more basically than that, just in the reversibility of physical law, then it seems like you have to believe that the qubits that fell into the black hole are still there in the Hawking radiation. Problem is to explain how that can be. All right, so you can, you know, you can of course just assume that, all right, you know, because of some quantum gravity effects that we don't yet fully understand, you know, the you know, there are corrections to quantum field theory, you know, which we knew was sort of, you know, an approximate theory, and really the information, you know, should come out in scrambled form, so that, you know, the black hole is, you know, sort of conceptually, you know, from the standpoint of the faraway observer, you know, not that much different from a furnace that, you know, that burns the, you know, paper that you throw into it, or just, you know, some other ordinary physical system. But then that, you know, if you believe that, that led to another problem, which was the Xeroxing problem, which is if you, you know, take some quantum state and you throw it into the black hole, then if you imagined you know, one observer who is sort of outside the hole, then, you know, and they would see the state come back out in the Hawking radiation. But if another observer jumped into the black hole, then you might imagine that, you know, that they would see the state inside the hole, right? And so we seem to have, you know, two copies of the same state, you know, in the same world, you know, and this would violate what's called the no cloning theorem, which, you know, says there is no physical procedure that makes a copy of an unknown quantum state. Now, you know, people try to argue that, okay, maybe this is okay because maybe, you know, the same observer is never going to see both copies, right? If you, you know, if you jump in, then you're not, you know, you're not going to see the one outside. If you wait outside until the one outside comes out, then the one that's inside has already hit the singularity by then, okay? But this is, you know, this is, a, you know, at most sort of, I think, a partial answer because, you know, ultimately we want to know just kind of what is the relevant Hilbert space. Right, what is the relevant space of states, you know, if we want to think about this as quantum mechanics? And, you know, if states are being duplicated regardless of whether we can observe it or not, then, you know, then we just, you know, how do we understand what's the state space? So you know, that's just not linear evolution. So so people like toward the 1990s converged toward a viewpoint called a black hole complementarity, which says that actually the interior of the black hole is not even a separate a factor of Hilbert space at all. It's just a scrambled re-encoding of the same information that's already outside the hole or on the event horizon. So from this point of view, jumping into a black hole would just be a very convoluted way of measuring the same degrees of freedom that you could, in principle, also have measured if you had stayed outside the hole. So then, you know, people were sort of, you know, happy with that for a while. You know, I still didn't really understand it. Then what changed a few years ago is that, oh, you know, the experts sort of decided that they didn't understand it either. And so this is this infamous firewall issue, which was proposed by Almhiri, Maroff, Polchinski, and Sully. And, you know, what... what they did, you know, as I would explain it, is just to give a concrete example of, you know, an experiment that you could imagine doing, you know, not one you could actually do, but one you could imagine doing, you know, such that, you know, a bunch of principles that we would like to believe, you know, seem to, you know, lead to a really bizarre outcome. Okay, and so it's a way of sharpening the issue because it's a way to say, you know, look, if you think that you understand black holes, you need to be able to explain what would happen if this experiment were done, right? If, you know, so it's a way of operationalizing some of the questions, okay? The basic way it works is, you know, we consider a system with three parts. So H is the interior of a black hole, and you know this contains a lot of quantum information that's not accessible to us if we're outside the black hole. But it should eventually come out. For technical reasons, we're going to assume that this is an old black hole, which means one that has already radiated more than half of its qubits, or you know, more than half of its mass as Hawking radiation. Even think about doing this experiment, you'd have to wait 10 to the 70th years or so for the black hole to more than halfway evaporate. You know, we'll assume that you have a really long grant. Now R is going to be the Hawking radiation that's already come out a while ago. And B is Hawking radiation, which is just now coming out. Okay, so now we imagine, you know, our observer, Alice there, no matter what physical situation we're going to deal with, you know, we're going to try to uphold quantum mechanics and also uphold that we have Alice and Bob, okay? But here we only need Alice, I guess. Bob is off stage. By sort of very, very general arguments, you know, after the black hole is more than halfway evaporated, the state of the combined state of all the Hawking radiation, say R and B, cannot be a completely thermal state. Okay, like it can't be completely mixed. Because there just aren't enough degrees of freedom that are still inside the hole to trace out, you know, all of the purity of the qubits that are outside of it. Okay, which means, you know, the state, you know, of the joint state of R and B has to be something other than, you know, completely thermal or completely mixed state. And furthermore, you can give very, very generic arguments that almost certainly there's going to be, you know, in some entanglement between R and B. Okay, like if I thought of this as a Haar random state, or you know, it doesn't even have to be Haar random. It can be just any state that I get by applying a bunch of, you know, scrambling operations more or less randomly, then it will in general be true that there is some entanglement between R and B. Okay, that doesn't mean that I can easily detect that entanglement, you know. But in principle, I could imagine doing an experiment where I took all of the qubits of R, I loaded them into a quantum computer, so like I surrounded this black hole with, you know, perfectly absorbing surfaces. You know, I got all the photons, read all the state off of them. You know. Processed it all, you know, did some crazy measurement where I see that R and B are entangled. Like I measure a Bell inequality violation or whatever between some qubits of R and some qubits of B. Okay, and then the next part of the experiment is I jump into the hole. Okay, you know, this part, of course, you know, I can't publish a paper about, which is a little bit problematic. I could publish a paper for friends who were also inside the black hole, okay? But we would like the laws of physics to, you know, give an account of what happens if I jump in the final, you know, minutes or hours of my life. So now there's a problem because quantum field theory says that, you know, in order for Alice to perceive a smooth space-time as she jumps in, the qubits of B have to be maximally entangled with qubits that are just inside the hole. Okay, so each photon that comes out has to have an entangled partner photon, which is just inside the event horizon, which I would see if I jump in. And it's, you know, amazingly the case that if there's not this, you know, at least short-range entanglement all over the place in space-time, then quantum field theory says you do not have a smooth space-time geometry. Okay, in that case, Alice would just encounter an end of space-time, you know, right at the event horizon. Okay, but now the problem is that, you know, the qubits of B have to be maximally entangled both with the, you know, qubits of R and with qubits that are inside the hull, and the same observer, Alice, you know, can observe both of these things. Okay, so, you know, and this violates a basic principle of quantum mechanics, which is called the monogamy of entanglement, which has the same qubit, you know, just cannot be maximally entangled with two other things. That just doesn't even make sense, just considered as a quantum state. Okay, so the question is, what gives, right? You know, and you could say that Alice just encounters, you know, fine, bite the bullet. Alice encounters an end of space time at the event horizon that was called a firewall, you know, and or you know, you could say that the question is not even meaningful because, you know, what happens in a black hole stays in a black hole, you know, and the rest of us just don't need to know, right? But that seems a little unsatisfying. You could give up on, you know, the on the, you know, on unitarity, on the information coming out, you know, a lot of people, you know, I think, you know, partly motivated by this ER equals EPR work of Maldacena and Susskind, converge toward a, you know, a point of view that you know makes some sort of sense to me, which says that well, yes, you know, if you believe that what's inside the hull is, you know, just a scrambled re-encoding of what's outside the hull, in other words, if you really believe in black hole complementarity, then it's no surprise that, you know, by acting by doing some unitary transformation on, you know, the Hawking radiation, that you could arbitrarily mess up the structure, the geometry of space-time inside of the hull. Right, I mean, if they're just different re-encodings of the same thing, then you could say that has to be the case, right? That, you know, you can affect one by acting on the other. Okay, so from that point of view, you know, the question is just, you know, you could say yes, if Alice did this crazy quantum computation on the Hawking radiation, then yes, she could create a firewall. Okay, she could, you know, or in Susskind's example, she could send a happy birthday message to her friend who's inside the black hole. Okay, she could, you know, transform the state inside the hole however she likes. That's just a logical consequence if you believe complementarity. Okay, but then the question from this perspective is, how hard would it be for Alice to do any of these things? So, you know, can we at least say that under ordinary physical circumstances, you know, if she jumps into the black hole, then, you know, all her observations will be very well described by low energy, you know, quantum field theory and general relativity, you know, just as you know, physicists have believed for decades, and that, you know, it's only if she did something really bizarre and extreme that that, you know, that she would ever, you know, encounter anything like a firewall. Okay, and okay, but then, you know, the question is, well, what do you mean by really bizarre and extreme? Okay, well, you know, it so happens that, you know, the field of computational complexity, you know, you know, has lots and lots of tools for formalizing what you mean by something being, you know, bizarre or extreme or crazy or complicated. So maybe, you know, maybe it's natural that there should be a connection. And so what Harlow and Hayden did is that they gave an argument that Alice's sort of first task, just, you know, the task of decoding the Hawking radiation, would take exponential time. And here we don't mean, you know, like 10 to the 70th years, right? That would be merely the ordinary thermodynamics type of hardness, if that's what we were talking about. We're talking about like something like 2 to the 10 to the 70th years, okay? We're talking about that she would need an amount of time that's exponential in the total number of qubits in the black hole. Okay, and if that's the case, then we could say, Well, look, the black hole would have long ago evaporated before, she'd made a dent in the computation. So then there's nothing for her to jump into. So maybe there's no problem. Okay. So this would be a very, very strong sense in which, a firewall cannot, be created in any, ordinary circumstance. And it would also be sort of a very, very novel use of, of computational complexity in physics. Okay, but now a lot of people sort of will immediately object on hearing this and say but are you saying that an inconsistency in the laws of physics is okay just as long as it would take exponential time to uncover it, right? Because that seems absurd. That seems like totally unsatisfactory. Okay, so I think it's crucial to understand that's not what anyone's arguing here. Okay, the inconsistency would only be one in low energy quantum field theory, right? So presumably the true quantum theory of gravity is completely consistent, so forth. But the issue is that there are sort of physicists thought that low energy field theory should describe, an observer who passes through the event horizon, in any ordinary circumstance. Okay, and they knew that it would. They already knew that the field theory would break down if you did measurements, for example, at the Planck, energy, right? We already knew that field theory is just an approximation to something else, okay? But what this is saying is that, you could, make the approximation break down not only by making measurements at the Planck energy, but also by solving exponentially hard computational problems. Okay, that's sort of the novel part here. So, the obvious sort of caveats of complexity arguments, first of all, they're asymptotic, right? We can only sort of do asymptotic reasoning in this field. So like for, the usual joke is for a complexity theorist, right? Chess is completely trivial. It's solvable in O of one time, right? Because there's only finitely many configurations on the board. So just enumerate them all, and you're done. Okay, we're interested in scaling, as some, input size gets large or something. But, in the case of a black hole, fortunately, we are dealing with extremely large inputs, like 10 to the 70th qubits or whatever. And and if we were dealing with a microscopic black hole, no one ever thought that quantum field theory would be a good description of such black holes anyway. So for those, there's not a firewall problem to begin with. We always have to base things, if we want to argue about hardness, we almost always need to base things on conjectures, like that P is not equal to NP, or that, there exists a one-way function, which is, easy to compute but hard to invert. Or often even stronger assumptions than that. Okay, I was, when I, talked about this to quantum gravity people, some of them criticized me for this, and I, my only answer was, with, very respectfully, for quantum gravity people to be, criticizing us for, having too many conjectures, just seemed weird to me. So if you like, these are just laws of nature. Okay, this, P not equal to NP and so forth. And then the third caveat is that, we can't rule out that there could be some crazy symmetry or some special cancellation that's very, very specific to, black holes that would somehow make, what we're arguing to be hard problems, easy, right? We can just argue that the generic case of the problem is hard, and that, for sort of a given what we know about black holes, that we don't see any reason why you shouldn't be in the generic case. Okay, a black hole is pretty, is pretty much scrambling things up in a crazy way. And, if you just consider, generic kind of scrambling transformations, then in general, you'll have a hard problem. Okay, so, all right, so the first step that one does, in this business is to sort of model whatever is happening in a black hole by some kind of quantum circuit. Okay, quantum circuit is something that looks like that. It acts on a collection of qubits, which are just two-level systems, and it applies a bunch of gates, which are unitary transformations that are reasonably local, that just act on a few of the qubits at a time and as the identity on all the others. Okay, and we think of, quantum computer science, we think of sort of anything that can sort of plausibly happen in the physical world as corresponding to some reasonable sized quantum circuit, like let's say one of polynomial size. Okay, so we'll imagine that the action of the black hole is some whatever it is, whatever the true quantum theory of gravity describes, we'll think of it as applying some polynomial size quantum circuit, and you could say like maybe we have to discretize to get things into this form. On the other hand, if you believe the holographic principle, then there should only be a bounded amount of entropy inside the black hole anyway. So the number of qubits that are needed to describe the complete state of the black hole should be at most like the black hole surface area in Planck units divided by 4, I guess. Okay. So now I can state what was Harlow and Hayden's decoding problem, and it was you're given as input a description of a quantum circuit that prepares some kind of entangled state of the R, B, and H, the exterior just emitted and interior regions. And now, we're promised that by only acting on the old Hawking radiation, so by only acting on the R part, it is possible to distill an EPR pair between R and B. For simplicity, I'll imagine B to consist of only one qubit. Okay, and so then it is possible to put that qubit into an EPR pair with, let's say, the last qubit of R by acting only on R. Okay, and so now our task is to distill such an EPR pair by applying some unitary transformation U sub R only to the qubits in R. Okay, and so now people might say, isn't this decoding task trivial? Because after all, if we know the quantum circuit C, that corresponded to the black hole's action, and in this game, I'm gonna give that to you for free. So you know all the laws of physics. You know the complete state of all the matter that fell in to make the black hole. Let's just throw all of that out for free. Okay, and you might say, well, then it's easy because then just apply C inverse, and then that will just get you back to your original state. The problem is that you can't apply C inverse because you don't have access to all the qubits. Many of them are still inside the black hole. Okay, and you can't wait for it to evaporate because then you couldn't do the second part of the experiment. So the issue is that you need to somehow apply this unitary U sub R only acting on the qubits that have already come out of the black hole. Okay, and now information theoretically, we know from an abstract dimension counting argument that such a unitary U sub R exists. Right, there exists a unitary that will distill this entanglement. But the dimension counting argument that tells us it exists says nothing about how to apply it, that it should be efficiently applicable, right? We would in general get if we tried to build a quantum circuit to do it, it would in general be exponentially large. Okay, so now the question is genuinely one of complexity, right? It's can you get a polynomial size quantum circuit that would apply this distilling unitary U sub R to the Hawking radiation that we know in principle has to exist. And you could just look at this, argument, and say, well, I don't see how to apply U sub R. It's probably exponential time, but to their great credit, Harlow and Hayden were not content to stop there. They said, we want to give an actual argument for hardness. Okay, and the way that we do this in computer science is typically by reduction, which basically just means passing the buck to someone else. Okay, and saying, well, I can't prove that my problem is hard, but if it's easy, then these 10,000 other things are also easy. So you go chew on that. Okay, So here, this is not quite the way that, that they phrased it, but I'll put this in terms of what's called the set equality problem. Okay, this is a black box problem where you know you're given say you know black boxes that compute two functions f and g from n bits to you know maybe some polynomial in n number of bits. I'll assume for simplicity that these functions are injective, and now you're promised that the ranges of these functions are either equal or they're disjoint, okay? And your task is to decide which. Okay, so you know you get these two functions. Are there, you know, they both like have exponentially many possible inputs. The problem. So you know, enumerating all the outputs would be way too expensive. Okay, but you want to know: are there outputs? Are there output ranges equal or disjoint? So now you know. Those of you in quantum computing might recognize this as a variant of the collision problem. Okay, the collision problem says that you just have a single function f, which is either promised to be either 1-to-1 or 2-to-1, and you need to decide which. Okay, this one is a little bit more structured than that. But in my PhD thesis in Berkeley, in just 2002, or so, you know, one of the main things that I did was to prove a quantum lower bound for the collision problem. Okay, so I showed that any quantum algorithm to find, to decide if a function is 1-to-1 or 2-to-1 is going to have to query the list, at least like 2^n/5 times. Okay, where n is the number of bits in the input strings there. Okay, and that was subsequently improved to 2^n/3 by Yao Yin Shi. For the set equality problem, I was able to prove a lower bound of 2^n/7, and that was very recently improved to 2^n/3 by Mark Gendry. Okay, and so so that's some of the evidence that we have that this problem, like set equality, is likely to be generically hard even for a quantum computer. Okay, so it has, if you notice, like it has some kind of global structure. It feels maybe it's kind of like Simon's problem or Shor's period finding problem. So a priori, you might have imagined that there would be fast quantum algorithms for these sorts of problems. But we can rule that out, and that's something that we sort of learned how to do 12 or 13 years ago in quantum complexity theory. Okay, and so when you can just imagine when I read this paper with all the that had string theory and black holes, and I said I'm not going to understand anything, and then you get to the core point, which is why is this problem actually hard, and it's the collision Wheeler bound. Well, I sort of have no choice but to get interested in it at that point. So I should say, even in the real world, if F and G were sort of not black boxes, but were described to you explicitly, if you had a fast quantum algorithm to solve this sort of problem, that would also give you a fast quantum algorithm, for example, for graph isomorphism, okay, which is a problem for which we don't yet know efficient quantum algorithm, although people have been searching for one. And more generally, it would let you solve all of the problems in a complexity class called SZK, or statistical zero knowledge. Okay, that was one of the classes I had in my picture from before. Okay, so now I can state the theorem of Harlow and Hayden, which says, suppose that there were a fast quantum algorithm to solve this general decoding problem, that I stated before of decoding entanglement from Hawking radiation, then there would also be a polynomial time quantum algorithm for set equality. Okay, which again, in the black box setting, definitely does not exist, and even in the real world, we believe very strongly should not exist. If it exists, then statistical zero knowledge would be contained in quantum polynomial time in BQP. Okay. All right, so their construction, I won't go into too much detail, but basically you can take this set equality problem and you can encode it into the distilling problem. So you create imagine creating a state like this one, which has the property that, and this is very easy to prepare if you can access F and G. And this has the property that if F and G had disjoint ranges, then the H register, the stuff that's inside of the black hole, decoheres all of the entanglement between R and B. Okay, you see that, right? Whereas if F and G have the same ranges, then it doesn't decohere the entanglement, you know. So now even just to solve, you know, if we could distill the entanglement, then surely we could also solve the decision problem of deciding whether there is entanglement there to be distilled, you know, at all. But even just to solve that decision problem can be at least as hard as solving set equality, you know, because of this sort of construction. And it's really just, you know, a matter of formalizing that. Okay, so a year or two ago, you know, obtained a strengthening of this argument where I can eliminate the reliance on my PhD thesis. Now the argument actually just can be based on any one-way function. So if you have any one-way function which is easy to compute and hard to invert, then we can use that to you know, we can embed that into the problem of decoding the Hawking radiation. Okay, and I should say that we very, very firmly believe, you know, or many of us do, that there should be one-way functions that are hard to invert even using a quantum computer. Okay, and that surprises some people because, you know, of course, the one-way functions that we often use in real life are things like, you know, Diffie-Hellman, you know, RSA, you know, elliptic curve. They're based on things like that. All of those can be broken using variance of Shor's algorithm. Okay, but if you just want, you know, even if you wanted like a trapdoor one-way function, which is what you need for public key cryptography, you know, or you know, but certainly if you just wanted an ordinary one-way function, which is what suffices for private key cryptography, okay, then you could just do some arbitrary kind of scrambling up of your input, you know, with no very special structure to it. And we think of inverting such a thing as sort of morally almost as hard as solving NP-complete problems. You know, there's no equivalence proven, but they're, you know, they're sort of morally similar. This is just beyond what we currently sort of think, you know, expect that even a quantum computer would be able to do efficiently. You know, you like probably it could give you the advantage of, you know, coming from Grover search, you know, and maybe something else like that. Okay, but to invert all one-way functions in polynomial time would be very surprising. So what we do here is that we use a famous theorem of Goldreich and Levin, who are, you know, neither of whom believes in quantum computing at all, but that's okay. We'll use their theorem, and it says that every one-way function has what's called a hardcore predicate. Okay, it has, you know, so there's some bit, you know, like if f is your one-way function and I tell you f of x, then there is some bit about x that knowing only f of x, you cannot predict better than chance. If you could predict it better than chance, you know, this type of bit, then you could invert f, okay? And the function would not have been one way. So we use that hardcore bit, which is actually just an inner product, x dot s modulo 2, where s is some random other string. And I take the exclusive OR of x dot s with a, where a is some, you know, additional bit, and you know, so I put one of them in B, I put the rest in R, and this construction, you know, has the property that even just to see that R and B were correlated, you know, forget about entangled, even just to see that they're classically correlated, you know, you would need the ability to predict, you know, x dot s better than chance given only f of x, which would then let you invert f. Okay, so that, you know, Daniel Harlow had asked, you know, can you show that even just decoding correlation or, you know, revealing the state as something other than like a completely mixed state, you know, would already require computational superpowers? And this is you know, arguing yes. Okay, so you get this view of, you know, computational intractability, you know, some sort of armor, you know, protecting the geometry of space-time, right? That you know, from all these results, right? If you could invert a one-way function, then, you know, you could, you know, looks like you could do something that, you know, that ought to create a firewall. But somehow in, you know, as long as we're limited to efficient computations, then, you know, the picture of a smooth space-time geometry is somehow protected from our meddling. So I found that very striking. Okay. Yeah.
There's a lot of entanglement between between R and B,
mm-hmm.
and you're only using one qubit. So in fact, the actual physical scenario would be an even harder problem.
Absolutely, you're absolutely right. I mean, in fact, you know, you could object that, you know, well, the real physical scrambling situation that, you know, doesn't look like, you know, anything that would, you know, create, you know, this kind of, you know, nice, regular, computer science-y looking state, right? It would be, you know, much more chaotic and much messier than that. But, you know, intuitively, that fact only seems to make the decoding problem harder and not easier, right? So, like, in some sense, what we're saying is that even if the state had this very regular form, you know, even then, you know, decoding would be at least as hard as inverting a one-way function. You know, in the real case, presumably, it's, you know, it's even harder. Although I don't know how to formalize that intuition, and that's, I regard as a very good open problem.
But the last part of what you said, which is that even correlation is hard to extract.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I'm a bit confused because there is no monogamy theorem.
That's right, but there is monogamy between entanglement and correlation. So there's no monogamy between correlation and correlation. But if one qubit is supposed to be entangled with another, then it can't, you know, then it can't have any side action going, even if it's only correlation, right? Okay. Yeah, good. All right, so now, you know, I want to discuss another, connection. This was a very, very recent. So this is, I guess, work in progress with Lenny Susskind, and so we're, you know, trying to sort of make a reasonably formal connection between quantum circuit complexity and ADS, the ADS CFT correspondence. Okay, and. So what is ADS-CFT? Okay, so it's this duality between between a theory with gravity that lives in like d space-time dimensions and a theory and just a conformal field theory, so a quantum field theory with no gravity that lives in d minus one space-time dimensions. It has not yet been proved rigorously that this connection exists, but, you know, look, you know, P not equal to NP hasn't been proved either, physicists will say that, you know, that this correspondence has survived many, many checks, you know, despite how surprising it is, and that it, you know, relates a theory with gravity to a theory without gravity, and, you know, and relates theories in different numbers of dimensions. Okay, so it's really a striking thing, and it's, you know, regarded as one of the main things that's actually like understood today about quantum gravity, or, you know, at least depending on who you ask, and because it lets you, you know, take questions about, you know, the formation and evaporation of black holes and so forth, at least, you know, in an ADS space, so, you know, in a negatively curved, you know, space-time, an anti-de Sitter space, and it lets you map those to questions, you know, about just a completely ordinary quantum field theory. So if you like, just a collection of qubits evolving by some unitary transformation, okay? And then, in fact, you could just define what you mean by quantum gravity to mean, you know, I mean whatever is dual to this collection of qubits, you know, evolving by this unitary, okay? Of course, that still leaves the problem of, like, understanding, well, great, then how do I apply the duality? You know, if I have this collection of qubits, how do I interpret that in terms of a space-time geometry, right? But that's a question that many, many people, you know, have been working on, you know, in the last 3 or 4 years, and there's a lot of, they're trying to understand it. Okay, I should say, you know, this is an extremely non-local mapping. In fact, you know, there's recent work that says that, like, the mapping from the bulk or the, you know, the ADS space to the boundary CFT can be literally understood as an example of a quantum error correcting code. Okay, quantum error correcting code, you know, being something that's, you know, inherently like a non-local encoding of quantum information. All right, so that's an amazing connection, but not the one that I'm going to be talking about now. So the story that I want to tell here starts with an observation that was made a few years ago by Susskind and collaborators, I guess, which said that if you take what's called the thermofield double state, so this is like just a particular, you know, ADS state that involves, you know, two like regions of space-time that are separated, except that they're connected by a wormhole. Okay, and now you just apply completely classical general relativity. It tells you that this wormhole is just going to get longer and longer without bound. Okay, you know, depending on your coordinates, it will either just pinch off in a finite time, or, you know, you could say that it just keeps expanding forever. So, you know, that's a coordinate-dependent question. Okay, but now you could say, you could look at over on the CFT side, over on the, you know, the system of qubits, and you could say, what is happening over there, which is dual to the wormhole getting longer and longer. And what you find is that all you've got there is a collection of qubits that start out in a very simple state, you know, namely, you know, a collection of Bell pairs. So just a maximally entangled state, you know, between, you know, one, like, with one, with n Bell pairs for the left spacetime and n Bell pairs, and n qubits for the left spacetime and the, you know, n qubits for the right spacetime. Okay, so the wormhole is somehow represents entanglement between, you know, these two regions, and as the wormhole gets longer and longer, you know, that somehow just corresponds to more and more just scrambling happening to these qubits. So like some unitary transformation, you know, you can, without loss of generality, we can take it to happen to one of the halves only, okay, by pushing it through. And you know, so there's some unitary, like let's say the exponential of just a Hamiltonian that's just a sum of a bunch of two qubit terms. Okay, and that unitary just gets applied over and over. And so the qubits just get more and more scrambled up. Okay, and now here's the puzzle. Okay, if you looked at any sort of ordinary physical quantity, you know, about these qubits, like if you looked at the, you know, the 2 or 3 point correlation functions, or, you know, you looked at like the correlation between any small number of these qubits, then very, very quickly, you know, these qubits are going to start looking like they're just in the maximally mixed state. Okay, you know, they're going to look like, you know, they've just become completely thermalized, right? Just like, you know, if I have, you know, gas particles in one half of a box, you know, I let it mix, right? Very, very quickly, you know, it looks like the box has just reached, you know, equilibrium, and then nothing much further happens. Okay, but you know, on the ADS side, the wormhole is just continuing to get larger and larger without bound. Okay, so which means that something must still be happening, you know, on the CFT side. Okay, and of course something is still happening, namely unitary evolution, you know, is still going on, but it just doesn't seem to be, you know, having any, you know, easily describable effect. Okay, so the question was posed of what function or what property of the CFT state, you know, psi sub t, can we point to as being somehow dual to the length of the wormhole on the ADS side? Okay, and now can state Susskind's amazing proposal, which was that we should actually, you know, the best candidate that we can come up with is the quantum circuit complexity of the state psi to psi sub t. Okay, so quantum circuit complexity means the size of the smallest, the number of gates in the smallest quantum circuit that would prepare psi sub t starting from, you know, the all zero state. Okay, so to give some intuition, you know, the quantum circuit complexity of any n qubit state is at most 2 to the n, about 2 to the n, because, you know, you could always just prepare the, you know, the thing basis state by basis state. Okay, but, you know, for many, many natural states, the circuit complexity is polynomial in n, right? And so, you know, and this is often a very interesting question to ask about a quantum state. Okay, and So what we're saying here is that, well, you know, the one obvious thing that keeps going up as you apply more and more scrambling operations to, you know, a simple quantum state is, well, presumably its circuit complexity keeps going up. Okay, why? Because the only obvious way to prepare the state is to just mimic the physical evolution. You know, start with the, say, EPR pairs, and then just apply the requisite number of unitaries, right? But the longer the thing's been running for, the longer you have to run that simulation for. So intuitively, you would expect that the circuit complexity would just go up and up and up linearly until it gets all the way up to 2 to the n, and then it just sort of hits a ceiling there, you know, and then it just stays around there for actually for a double exponential amount of time, you know, until you get back to a recurrence. Okay, and now, you know, there are independent physical reasons to think that in quantum gravity, the length of the wormhole should also behave like this, right? It should go up and up and up until it gets exponential, and then it sort of has to hit a limit there for entropy reasons. Okay, so, you know, for you know, by Lenny's standards, this is a proof that the two are equal. Okay. But there are actually further checks that you can do where you can play more non-trivial games with the CFT state, and you can actually see that, you know, the wormhole length continues to just match the circuit complexity, which is a weird and interesting phenomenon. You know, I don't know how much to make of it, you know, because, you know, it may just be like an observed correlation. It may not be causal, right? You know, it may be that the circuit complexity and the length of the wormhole are both just reflections of something else, of something deeper. But, you know, but for now, this seems like, you know, about the best that we can do. Okay, so now, you know, the question that, you know, Lenny gave me in my consulting role was, all right, well, you know, it seems plausible that the circuit complexity of the state would just keep going up and up for an exponential amount of time, but is that actually true? Okay, you know, can you show, let's say, under some plausible complexity assumption that, you know, that the as you apply a scrambling unitary more and more, that you do get a state with larger and larger circuit complexity? Okay, so now that is a question in my wheelhouse. Yes. So here's the theorem, here's the simplest version of the theorem that we have. That, you know, suppose that U sort of does the scrambling unitary does something sufficiently interesting, and by this I basically mean that it does something which is computationally universal. Okay. So clearly we're going to have to make some assumption about U, right? If U, by the way, how much time do I have, Daniel? All right, 10 minutes. All right. So you know, if U were the identity transformation, then obviously it will never increase the circuit complexity at all. So we have to assume something about U, and, you know, and physicists had, you know, been talking about maybe that you would assume it's chaotic or something. What I'm going to assume is that it's computationally universal, which means like it implements the step function of some universal reversible cellular automaton, for example. Okay, that's a pretty, you know, mild assumption to make, I think, if U is supposed to describe, you know, the evolution of the real laws of physics. And so then, you know, under that assumption, you can indeed get that, you know, the circuit complexity C of psi t, you know, sort of is going to increase. It's going to certainly become at least super polynomial. You know, if you make strong enough assumptions, then it will become exponential. You know, assuming a plausible conjecture about complexity classes, which is that P space, which is the class of problems solvable just by an ordinary computer with a polynomial amount of memory, is not in this other thing called PP slash poly, okay? Which PP is a class that's believed to be, you know, a lot smaller than P space. If you know what it is, great. If not, you probably don't want to know. You know, and the slash poly means that this machine is given some advice that depends only on the length of the input and not on the input itself. Okay, and, you know, we would, almost all complexity theorists would believe that PP is so much smaller than P space that even with advice, you know, it should not be able to do P space. And if you believe that, then the result follows. Okay, and the, you know, a sketch of the proof, You know, well, it relies on another result that I proved back in grad school in 2004, which says that this class PP can be characterized in quantum terms. Okay, it is equal to the class of problems that you can solve efficiently with a quantum computer if you have the power of post-selection. Okay, if you can make some measurements and then just post-select on their outcomes. So PP is equal to this class called post-BQP. Okay, you know, and I was able to use that theorem to, to give simpler proofs, even just of classical facts about, you know, this class PP, you know, using the this quantum characterization. Okay, here I'm going to use that equivalence for a different purpose. I'm going to say, okay, suppose that the circuit complexity of this quantum state remained polynomial, then we could use that to solve p-space problems using a quantum computer with advice and with post-selection, right? So how do we do it? It's a construction like this. You can think of n EPR pairs as just a superposition over x tensor x for all possible inputs x. And you can, so suppose that you had a small circuit to prepare this kind of state, then that, you know, that it had small circuit complexity, then that state could just be described as advice to your post-BQP machine, which then prepares this state, and it then measures this first register, and it post-selects on getting some particular input x that it wants. And, you know, provided that that happens, then what's over here is the result of applying u to x an exponential number of times. But that can easily be seen to be a p-space complete problem if u is computationally universal. Okay, so we have a bunch of extensions of this result. For example, to deal with approximate circuit complexity, there you need to use what's called random self-reducible p-space complete problems to get the circuit complexity to become exponential. You know, we can also show that some complexity assumption is needed to get any result of this kind. For example, if p-space had polynomial-sized quantum circuits, then it really would be true that, you know, that C of psi t would never become more than polynomial. Okay, so for that reason, we really are connecting, with Susskind's conjecture, it really is connecting a belief about space-time geometry to a non-trivial, assumption about complexity classes. A favorite research direction of mine is to, understand more systematically what is the quantum circuit complexity of preparing states, complicated entangled states, and applying unitary transformations. You know, this has connections to quantum gravity, but also it's good for other things in quantum computing theory, like understanding quantum money, which is hard to counterfeit. Quantum algorithms, like the measurements that you need to do in algorithms for the hidden subgroup problem, and other things like that. Okay, here's one of my favorite problems, which Greg Cooperberg and I posed in a paper in 2007. Okay, for every n-qubit unitary transformation u, is it the case that there is some classical function f such that, you could implement u in quantum polynomial time if you had an oracle for f? Okay, I love this question. Basically, what it's asking is, if I gave you sort of unlimited classical computing power, as much of it as you wanted, then would that enable you to apply, whatever unitary transformations you wanted efficiently? Okay, I have some partial results about this problem, but, I don't have a solution. I would love to be able to solve problems like this one. It's not hard to show that for every, n qubit state, there is some function such that if you could compute it, then you could efficiently prepare that state, right? So there's a difference between preparing a state and applying a unitary here. Okay, and, I think there's a lot to do in just the complexity of, physical processes or physical transformations going beyond just, solving a traditional computational problem, that has some, say yes or no answer. Okay, a related grand challenge was just to classify all the possible sets of quantum gates in terms of which unitary transformations they can generate. This is another thing that I would love to be able to do, and just know like what sets of gates give you all the unitary, generate all the unitary transformations, which ones only keep you in some subspace, you know, and, you know, just have a criterion, even just to classify all the possible 1 and 2 qubit Hamiltonians is, you know, has not been done beyond our knowledge. My student Adam Boland and I managed to classify all the 2-mode beam splitters, which already took, you know, a lot of representation theory. Very recently, with 2 students, Daniel Greer and Luke Schaefer, we managed to give a complete classification of all the possible sets of classical reversible gates acting on bits in terms of which reversible transformations they can generate. Okay, so like, for example, you have this controlled NOT gate, which is, you know, which is not computationally universal, right? It can't do an AND function. You have the Toffoli, which is universal and in fact can do any reversible transformation. You string together enough of these. You've got the Fredkin gate, which is also computationally universal, but which never changes the total number of 1 bits. Okay, so it preserves the Hamming weight. Okay, but these are just 3 examples, right? What is the complete set of possibilities for what you could generate given some arbitrary collection of, you know, classical reversible gates? All right, so this is the answer. And you can, you know, we prove that this is the complete list of possibilities, and that's what we do. You know, it takes about 30 pages, but you know, we do it. You know, and this is to you know, orient you. This is just like would be a tiny piece of the problem of classifying all the possible quantum gate sets. Right, this is the classical subcase of that problem. Okay. Luke has, you know, done, you know, very beautiful things, you know, in the same direction. Like he's constructed the first example of a physically universal cellular automaton, which is a cellular automaton that can implement any desired transformation in a given region of within a given region by just suitably initializing the complement of that region. Okay, so we know lots and lots of cellular automata that are, you know, computationally universal, right? Like you can build a Turing machine out of Conway's Game of Life, for example. Okay, but you know, that doesn't mean that you can actually do any transformation of states that you might want to do, right? Again, it's this issue of physical complexity, right? The complexity of doing a physical, you know, or the ability to do a physical operation. Okay, but with Luke's automaton, you can actually do any transformation of states like within this little square in the middle that you would want. This is just a little bit of eye candy for, you know, what his construction looks like. And you can read his paper for the details. So I have this thing about coffee cups, but I think I'm out of time again. So this was a bonus. If someone wants to ask me about it later, I'll be happy to talk about it. But let me just summarize. So I think, you know, quantum computing established a remarkable intellectual bridge between computer science and physics, you know, and that's always been why I've cared about it. That's what drew me into the subject in the first place. You know, if we get actual useful devices out of it, you know, that's a cherry on the sundae. Okay, and so you know, my research agenda, in some sense, is just to see how much weight this bridge can carry, right? Just you know, how much you know, can we actually sort of interface between, you know, the actual non-trivial content of modern physics and complexity theory, you know, and not just at the level of metaphors. And, you know, like rebuilding or restating physics in the language of computation, I think was not nearly as easy as, you know, some people have claimed it would be, you know, because, you know, you can't just junk any part of physics that doesn't fit so easily, like quantum mechanics, for example. Okay, you have to engage, you know, our actual understanding of physics, certainly including quantum mechanics, ideally also quantum field theory, you know, and even you know, what the current ideas are about quantum gravity, you know, and it requires non-trivial mathematical work. And it, you know, and what's exciting about this, you know, is that even for classical theoretical computer scientists, right, it leads to new problems for them. It, you know, it puts new demands on them. So, you know, so I think it is ultimately possible to build this bridge, and that's what I'd like to continue trying to do. So, thanks.
Okay, let me start off then.
Yeah.
So going back to the Hyden-Harlow stuff.
Yeah.
So if you wait till a black hole evaporates completely, that's easy to infer.
Yeah. That's right.
Way. If you only have 51% of top radiation, that seems to be hard. So do we have any idea where the transition between the two is?
Okay. Excellent. So only after the black hole has more than halfway evaporated. Does it even become information theoretically possible to do the inversion? And okay, so at that point, it becomes information theoretically possible. Okay, and then you could say, at what further point after that does it become computationally easy to do? Well, I hadn't considered that question. Let's think. Okay, so yeah, when it's completely evaporated, then it is easy. And okay, you have one qubit over here. You have I would certainly expect that when any constant fraction of the qubits is still in the hole, that you have a hard problem. In fact, my guess would be that we could construct a problem whose hardness is going to be exponential in the number of qubits that are still in the hole. So that if you've got any polynomial number of qubits still in the hole, like n to the epsilon, I think I could construct a 2 to the n to the epsilon hard problem then, right? And then if there's only log n qubits, then maybe it's solvable in polynomial time. That's something that, if you like, I'll check later today. Okay. Yeah.
So it seems like your lower bound of the complexity says something like, if you wait for a really long time, then you get really large complexity. So I was just wondering if you have other complexity theoretic conjectures which allows to say that if you wait for polynomial time, you have lower bound polynomial complexity.
Oh yeah, okay. That's an excellent question. So basically, if you make a standard complexity conjecture, let me get to it. P space does not have a polynomial size post-selected quantum circuits, right? Then all I can get from that is that if you wait exponential time, you'll get super polynomial complexity. Okay, now, of course, someone like Susskind wants much more than that. Okay, he wants that the complexity literally increases linearly with the time, and that after polynomial time, you have polynomial complexity. After exponential time, you have exponential complexity. Okay, if you want that, then you have to stick your neck out and make a sharper complexity conjecture, right? So you could, for example, conjecture that P space requires exponential size circuits of this form. Okay, that's still a plausible conjecture. You're sticking your neck out further, but with that, you could get that after exponential time, the complexity of the state is c to the n for some constant c. Okay, I won't promise you that c is 2. Okay, but for some constant c. Okay, and if you really want that it's 2 to the n, then you're going to have to make a really strong conjecture, like that the circuit complexity of this process, literally just goes up linearly, right? And then the problem is that when you do reductions, normally there's some bits that go to waste. Like, for example, I could take my original p-space problem, that might involve 100 bits, but I couldn't map it to a 100-bit cellular automaton, right? Maybe I could map it to a 10,000-bit cellular automaton, right? Because I need all this control stuff to make it work. And that blow up in the reduction is what's going to prevent me from getting a 2 to the n lower bound on the quantum circuit complexity. So if I want that 2 to the n lower bound, then I need to believe that the problem is hard, is sort of the native problem is hard without needing to sort of embed any other problem into it that's going to cause this blow up.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah, sure. No problem. Yeah.
Could you go back to your comment about wormholes and AES and how the unitary that acts only on one part of all the EPR pairs in the CFT, how it's nice enough? What did you?
Sorry.
So you were talking about a unitary acting in the bulk?
Yes.
And what was the connection with how did it behave in the CFT?
Okay. So. Is there chalk here? Oh, yeah, here. All right, so the picture people draw of this thermofield double state looks like this. I don't know if this helps you. But there's, you know, the CFT is this bound, you know, these two boundary regions here and here, right? And this is the bulk. Okay, you know, I would maybe draw it just like this, right? That there's this wormhole that's getting longer and longer. So whatever unitary transformation is acting, right? And presumably it's the same unitary transformation acting in both cases, right? They're just different, you know, they're two different ways of looking at the same system, right? But the action of the unitary on the bulk is to make the wormhole longer and longer. And, you know, we know that just because, you know, because classical GR ought to be a good description, you know, for this kind of system, and GR says that it gets longer and longer, right? The dual description, you know, on the boundary, you know, if you believe in, you know, ADS CFT, is that you have a collection of qubits. They start out in some, you know, simple state, like the tensor product of a bunch of EPR pairs, and then what happens is just a bunch of, you know, a lot of unitary evolution. So let's say like e to the iht, you know, minus I, whatever, where h is a Hamiltonian that's a sum of a whole bunch of two qubit interactions. Okay, and you know, and then you know, you just t just gets larger and larger and larger. Okay, but it's a separate unitary acting on the left halves and acting on the right halves. The two halves don't interact with each other, right? And for this reason, you know, like we know that you know, if you have a singlet state, applying u to the left half is equivalent to applying u transpose to the right half. So you could always push everything over to one half.
Okay. Yeah. And could you? What if you considered the dual to the Hawking radiation?
Mm-hmm.
Have a similar kind of problem to pose?
That's a very good question. So Susskind likes to talk about, you know, what he calls you know, it's like this is an Einstein-Rosen bridge, right? This is a bridge between two regions of space-time. But you know, according to the ER equals EPR, if you believe that stuff, then a black hole should look like a bridge to nowhere. Okay, it should, you know, like, you know, like if you continued past the singularity, you just get this longer and longer region. And, you know, and presumably this would be, you know, if you just have a single black hole not connected to anything else, then, you know, this bridge to nowhere just gets longer and longer for exponential time. And, you know, and that should be dual to whatever is happening on the CFT side. Like for this kind of question, all I can do is like tell you what, you know, what the experts tell me. What they tell me, you know, is that they like this thermofield double state because for that one there's a very, very clean understanding. And with this bridge to nowhere, the picture is not quite as clean. But this is, you know, but they expect that the story would be broadly similar there. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Any other questions? All right, then let's thank Scott again. Mm-hmm.